UFO contact from planet ETB Rock Cancer Planet mission by Ludwig F. Paulman and Wendell C. Stevens. Herr Ludwig F. Paulman, a health food processing equipment salesman, working in Peru and hearing of a giant arrowroot species growing in the upper Peruvian Amazon, set out to find it. He departed from Leticia in an Indian dugout and was taken up a tributary of the Merrim River. Those Indians left him at the edge of their territory and he was picked up by another tribe who took him further up to an encampment of toga-garbed white-skinned people living in conical structures and served by silvery 30-meter diameter flying discs. Those beings told him they came from another planet they called ETB Ra. They were operating a plantation here where they were hybridizing plants from ETB Ra with ours. Introduction. In 1967 I delivered several Beechcraft T-34 trainer planes, see below, to the Peruvian Navy, making fuel stops at the last Colombian town, the river port of Leticia on the Amazon. I had to wait for the weather on the east side of the Andes to clear, and so I went down to the river dock to see what was coming in. On an impulse I decided to hire some native boatmen there to take me as far as they could go upriver and back in one day. The Yavari branch is off the Amazon, not very far downstream from Iquitos. I hired several natives with a dugout canoe to take me up the river into some wild jungle to view rare orchids and to snap some photographs. I wanted to get completely away from civilization for one day. As we putted along with their antique outboard motor tied on the rear, I remarked on the lush dense vegetation along the bank there and wondered why the natives made no plantations of some of the more rare and exotic tropical fruits that grew in great abundance, but which we never saw and most never heard of at home. I was certain there must be a market for them. It would only require a little organization. There were exquisite species like the Chirimoya, Momaya, Tumbo, Mandarina, Cuanabana and Guiba, all of which I thought would find a ready market in the United States. They were available here at every fruit stand from Colombia to Bolivia. I was even entertaining some ideas of hauling them back by the airplane load. The natives thought this might be too big a project for them. And then one of them said that he knew there were some Americans 3 or 4 days up the river who were doing just that. He knew of a white man who had gone up there to look for them some months ago and never came back down. These Indians had never seen the Americans and had only heard of them from wilder tribes farther upstream. We were on the main course of the Yavari at that time. Theo, he said they had airplanes up there. Gosh, my idea was already being exploited by somebody else. I asked about the man and somebody said he was Aleman, German. Americans? What kind of Americans? There weren't any Americans that I knew of up there, and why didn't the man come back? Why hadn't they seen the Americans? This was the only access to the region. They had to pass by here to get up there. Why hadn't the German come back? There was no other way out of the region. The natives didn't seem concerned. This was not their problem. I was always intrigued by the stories of Colonel Percy H. Fawcett, who disappeared in the jungles near here many years ago. He had found the ruins of an ancient lost city and was trying to get back to it. His disappearance became one of the great mystery legends of history. Here was another disappearance and nobody seemed to care. Is that what happened to Fawcett? If I disappeared, would anybody care? We went out a half day and then came back down to Leticia. I worried about that man. Back in Lima I was discussing this with Senor Robert Woods, who had heard such stories too, and he referred me to another Peruvian gentleman who was interested in such things and collected stories of that kind as a sort of hobby. I stayed over another night and arranged to meet this man at his home. Mentioning the comment by the Indians to him produced a nod of familiarity, and he hunted up a news clip in his files which seemed to refer to the event, or at least a similar one. According to the clipping, a Senor Ludwig F. Paulman, a German salesman who sold food processing equipment and health foods to a chain of stores in Lima, had gone upriver from Iquitos in the Peruvian-Brazilian border area looking for a giant arrowroot plant species for possible hybridizing for the health food business. He was looking for a greater yield by improving the strain. As the story went, when the Indians who were taking him upriver understood what he wanted, They asked him why he didn't go further upstream, about 3 more days' journey, to where a party of Americans were doing the same thing. He could make arrangements with them. Intrigued, he decided to do just that, only to find that these Indians would not go, but 1 more day upriver to where they would turn him over to another tribe for the rest of the trip. Unable to persuade them to change their minds, he resigned himself to the situation and accepted it when the time came. He paid off the boatman and let them return downstream. His new paddlers took him near the place inhabited by the Americans, but superstitiously would not go all the way, and they put him ashore with his equipment, pointing out where to go to find them. He reportedly walked to the camp, consisting of plastic-like teepee tents for shelter, and found fair-skinned people there. They were dressed in light toga-like garments and spoke a strange language. He hailed them in English, but they didn't seem to understand. Then he tried Spanish and German with no better luck. He got a limited response in French, and they welcomed him and provided him a place to stay. When he learned to communicate with them, he was told that they came from another planet outside of our solar system, which they called Itibira, that they were indeed hybridizing plants and stock to be taken there. They were served by 3 beautifully streamlined disc-shaped flying machines that were used to maintain contact with others like them. After some time in this place, he knew that his business associates would be worried about his being missing so long, and he began to make plans to leave. The Itibirians graciously offered to deliver him to his destination in one of their aircraft, and they loaded him up to go. He decided, because of his long absence, to go to his ranch in the Dominican Republic instead of to Lima, and was taken there in 15 minutes. That was the story reported in the newspaper in Lima. This didn't quite fit the story at the river, but it had some of the elements, and more importantly to me was the reference to the disc-shaped flying machines. I had been chasing UFOs for over 25 years, and here was a fantastic case if there was anything to it. Now my curiosity was heightened by the double mystery. They were centered in the same place. I had to know more. I tried to get in touch with Mr. Palman before starting home. A couple of the specialized food stores knew of him but did not know how to find him in Lima because he came to them. My trail ran out and I had to leave for Tucson. By then I had come to accept the reality of UFOs as a phenomenon, because I had encountered phenomenal cases all around the world and there were frequent reports from everywhere. These strange objects seemed to be intelligently operated and controlled vehicles which clearly exceeded our own existing Earth technology, but I had not quite accepted the occupants, if there were any. Obviously, if they were intelligently controlled, then there must be someone intelligent aboard, but I did not know how I could deal with that problem. Anybody with any rational sense of science at all knew that the stories of human occupants was absurd, because in all the miracles of creation and evolutionary adaptation for survival, the happenstance chance of life anything at all like ours evolving from the accidental stroke of lightning in the primordial soup of chemicals of an embryonic planet at the right time, into the right mix, to start an evolutionary chain that would parallel ours in any degree at all was statistically ridiculous. Another humanity like us made the whole idea inconceivably remote, therefore stories involving human occupants of UFOs were strictly for science fiction fans and did not deserve study. To give serious consideration to such stories was putting oneself on dangerous ground. Fuzzy balls, hairy masses and slimy blobs were much more acceptable. No, human occupants were out, but the stories persisted and were interesting. And I continued to chase the tales of UFO sightings and activities all over South America. One thing that puzzled me was the fact that very primitive people, completely out of touch with civilization, told stories very similar to others described clear around the world from them. These did not have any preconceived ideas or any concepts to be trained out of them, and they simply accepted the visitors as visitors in the same way that they accepted me as a visitor, and we were both equally real to them. This may account in some measure for the seemingly higher incidence of contact with more primitives. They referred to the UFO nauts as brothers from the sky, as any investigator in those areas well knows. There were cases where they were not as brotherly, however, and they also occurred in remote locations completely out of touch with mainstream humanity. A wealthy Bolivian businessman of excellent reputation whom I have personally known for 15 years and for whom I have delivered more than a dozen air transport planes for his local cargo airline operation out of La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, confided a story that took place in the hills above one of his 17 ranches on the east side of the Andes. In 1969 I had flown a recently acquired Douglas C-54 transport plane down to his ranch at Santa Rosa, just up the Rapilo River from the Rio Maymore. He had a meat processing plant at this ranch and dressed out cattle for his neighboring ranchers also. Above his property to the west was a sheep herd with a large flock, some of which Oscar Bowles occasionally dressed out for the neighbor and hauled to market. We were sitting around a family-style table having lunch of wild ostrich eggs scrambled with grated beef when I asked if they ever saw Platillos volans around there, and demonstrated with the saucer under my coffee cup. The ranch hands said, "Wooa, machos han visto, many have seen them." Then Oscar told me a story they were all familiar with which had taken place at the shepherd's neighbor's property. The shepherd and two of his Indian helpers were watching the flock on a grassy hill one day, when they saw a silent, disc-shaped aircraft come out of some of the scattered white clouds in the bright blue sky overhead. It glided softly down in a curving approach as it bobbed gently on the air currents, until it was only 50 feet above their heads. It stopped and hovered a moment, and then from the bottom of the craft came flashes of white light, like electricity jumping a gap, about 30 times in quick succession, and the sheep struck by the rays fell to the ground in the flock. As it became apparent that the flock was the target of interest, the shepherd picked up a stick and, raising it, started to run toward the slowing shiny metallic disc. With his first threatening motion of raising the club there was a flash of violet light and he suddenly was unable to continue the motion. It was like he was immersed in molasses. He could barely move and then very slowly. He could roll his eyes and look around. He saw his helpers apparently in the same kind of paralysis. He could think clearly and wondered who was in such a vehicle. The stricken sheep did not move, as he watched. The silver disc-shaped craft with a shiny dome on top, descended still more, to about 5 or 6 feet above the ground, and a trapdoor with a built-in stair opened down from underneath, and two human-like feet started down the stair from the center of the ship. First one and then another emerged, and as they reached the bottom of the stair and stepped off he was sure they were normal men in the strange suits. The suits were a bright, reflective white, one-piece coverall type of garment with a transparent helmet over the head on top. The helmet was of dark glass and the suits fitted the body well. They each carried what looked like a shiny silver fire extinguisher bottle with a handle in one hand, and a black nozzle on the end of a white hose to the bottle in the other. They wore white gloves and white boots matching the suit. These two men walked around among the flock putting the fire extinguisher nozzle to each of the fallen sheep in turn. Apparently showing little interest in the shepherds, they finished their task in only 3 or 4 minutes and then walked back and boarded the ship up the stairway. The stair attracted as the big circular ship, over 30 feet in diameter, drifted higher, to about 300 to 400 feet above. From that position there was a shoo and the ship sped up into the blue sky at a steep angle and disappeared still going up. As soon as it was gone the sheep herdsmen came out of their paralysis and remained unsteady for only a moment and then rushed to the aid of the stricken sheep. There were 34 of them and they were all dead. The shepherd and his helpers dragged the dead sheep to one side and cut their throats to bleed them, but they did not bleed. The three men carried the carcasses to the hut and began to dress them out. They not only found them bloodless, they found certain organs considerably desiccated and spongy, including the brain, spleen and eyeballs. They decided not to eat the meat of those animals. The witnesses insisted that the UFO nauts looked like any other ordinary Earth humans in shape and size. They thought that the airplane was a marvelously beautiful piece of machinery. Those beings certainly looked human and they were quite sure that they did not come from any place on Earth. I had to agree. But what of the relatively high incidence of reporting human-like UFO nauts? A turning point for me was when I investigated a UFO landing in Ecuador in 1972. And it was between Cuenca and Azogues, in the middle of the night, that a spectacular UFO landing observed by many witnesses took place. The UFO was first seen as a brilliant pinkish-red star in the southwest sky, many times as bright as the brightest stars in the midnight moonless blackness of that night. The owner of the first self-serve supermarket in Cuenca, who lived with his wife and children east of town on the Cuenca-Azogues Highway, was unaccountably awakened at 1:20 after midnight and got up. Looking out the front windows, he saw this very strange star moving and got his wife up to see it. They both watched for a moment and she went and awakened their 17-year-old son, who also joined them in time to see the star, now a brilliant yellow-orange in color, land on a grassy meadow on their side of the river and beyond the highway. The light dimmed down to a reddish glow with intermittent red flashes. Then two brilliant white narrow beams of light came on and shone straight up into the sky. The local Toyota dealer in Cuenca and a party of nine people in a station wagon returning from a family gathering in the countryside south of this point were just crossing the river on a bridge to the north when they saw the pinkish red star to their west. It was moving east in a slow floating trajectory below the ridge line to the southwest, like it was looking for something on the ground. They observed the color change to reddish orange and the intermittent flashes of red light blinking. They reached the intersection and turned left onto the highway to Cuenca. The driver pulled over to the right and stopped, and they all got out to see this orange and red light bigger than a full moon in size. As it continued to descend, they observed a ring of small blue lights on the underside near the rim and watched it until it settled behind some trees between them and the river and disappeared. Then they got back in the car and proceeded to Cuenca. About that same time of night, a county highway supervisor, aged 48, and his 15-year-old son were returning to Cuenca from where he worked at Azogues. They were giving another adult highway engineer who worked for the same department a ride with them. At about 1:35, as they rounded a switchback overlooking the same river and bridge to the south, they saw ahead and beyond the road bridge to the west, between the river and the road, what looked like a car that must have left the reed at high speed and crashed with its headlights pointing straight up. This driver pulled over to the right and stopped, and all three men got out and crawled down the bank to the meadow level a few feet below. There, as they got closer, they could see through the willow brake between them and the crash that there were three men moving about outside of the car, but this car was very different and it had not crashed. It was a dark, circular, metallic vehicle with a raised dome about the size of a Volkswagen Bug on top of a sloping circular all-around flange, and seemed to be resting on three cylinder-like legs. It had dozens of small dim alternately spaced red and blue lights around the underside of the rim. The ground underneath dimly reflected the red and blue glow. There was a red beam like a searchlight that seemed to rotate slowly around the outside rim of the craft, which illuminated the surrounding trees and side of the mountain above the highway each time it came around. Besides that, there were two brilliant, narrow, white beams of light that shined straight up from a tube-like cylindrical device that projected through the metal housing just below the cockpit dome in front. A sliding door was open in the canopy and three human beings in white, close-fitting, one-piece, coverall jumpsuits were standing outside on the grass. One of them had his left foot up on the rim flange and stretching forward over that leg, was doing something to the cylinder that housed the two vertical white beams. The other two stood behind him and to his right, one closer to the open door of the ship. The middle one was holding some tools in his hands and handed one to the repairman doing the work. This act strangely looked like it was done in slow motion, or like underwater. All three men had their heads uncovered and were breathing our air. The uniforms were all alike and of the same strangely scintillating or shiny white material. There didn't seem to be any collars or cuffs, or any buttons or seams, and no pockets, in the uniforms. The only thing that looked familiar was a kind of black epaulette on the shoulders of all three, like a Navy uniform, the witnesses said. One of the UFO nauts turned and looked right in the direction where the three men were crouched behind a raised water conduit running through the separating willow brake, And at that point, the 15-year-old became so frightened he began to vomit. His father ordered him back to the car, but he was too afraid to go alone and his dad had to take him. The other man refused to be left alone, and so they all went to the car together, where the father locked the youth in and went back with the other man to their viewing vantage point. When they got back of the landing place, the three UFOnauts were inside the red illuminated cabin. The two bright white lights were out, and the red rotating light had speeded up. The red and blue rim lights were much brighter and had color beams shining down. There were several orange beams of light shining down also from the center underneath, and the whole ship now seemed to be going through the color changes of heating up metal. It rose slowly to about 50 feet as it retracted the cylinder landing gear with round foot pads on the bottom, and the red beacon sped up to a blur. It glowed through red to pinkish orange to orange and suddenly shot off, like a ping-pong ball struck fiercely and ricocheting between two close walls, almost like a zigzag lightning strike. Now here was one very difficult case to dispute. I had discovered these three parties independently. Until then, they each knew nothing of anybody else's experience that night. They each thought they were the only ones to witness this event, and all of them hesitated to tell anybody else for fear of ridicule. It was never written up by any of them until we did it together a few weeks after it happened. They only contacted me because I had given a UFO slide lecture in Quinia, and I was an outsider and therefore no danger to them. They all refused to let their names be used and refused to let me publish their names in Ecuador. There has been no media coverage of this case and the witnesses are unknown to each other. There was no mistaking the humans. They were just like us. I had to revise all my thinking. First the unsupported Palman story. Then the Bolivian shepherd who had lost his sheep to some UFOnauts who arrived in a disc-shaped craft. And twin Aymara Indian brothers meeting human beings near Lake Markawasi who took them inside their disc-shaped spacecraft and to an underwater base. Other stories I had heard from the Indians of the Andes and the Amazon basin of their brothers from the sky, which I had interpreted to mean angelic beings in their religious mythologies, all took on new meaning. When Antonio Nectar, a Javara medicine man in the Javeria above Sucua, in eastern Ecuador, said that the brothers were real and were flesh and blood like you and I had to believe him. He thought their disc-shaped craft no more remarkable than our helicopters, and from his point of view I could not disagree. His analogy was an interesting one. He didn't have either creationist or evolutionist theories to worry about, and scoffed at both arguments as being very silly. When I asked him of his origins, he swept his arms around over the whole jungle to the east and said their ancestors came from a great land to the west, now gone. Those, in turn, came from another world before this. He said the brothers from the sky still come from those other worlds and he knew that there were many up there. Not complicated at all to him. He did not wish to go to the United States and he did not wish to go to another planet. But why human? How many species of humans are out there? I suppose a single analogy on the world scale might be found in the insect kingdom. There are scores of species catalogued and maybe as many more not yet discovered. They are found everywhere, in the air, on the ground, underground, in and under water, under snow and dense darkness and brilliant light. Some can survive in heat and some in cold, some in dry and some in wet, and even intense radiation environments. They come in a great number of sizes and in every conceivable variety. There are great differences in eye structure, mouth, respiratory system, wings, if they have them, leg structure, etc., yet they all have six legs, an exoskeleton, a horizontal frame and stereo sensing. They did not evolve in a linear chain, one from another, in an unbroken sequence, and they are found in every part of the world without exception. Is it any more complicated to realize that an infinite creator might also provide a great number of different species in the human kingdom, perhaps on an even greater scale, and endow them with the ability to propagate from planet to planet as insects propagate from locality to locality? Maybe only a few basics are common, such as an erect form, a torso, a single head, and two arms and two legs, both with appendages. from the diversity of unit adaptation, as with the insects, might be considerable. I don't think the lightning strike in chemical slime is really a tenable origin, and suggest that perhaps some of these UFOnauts may be right when they say that humanity migrates from planet to planet just as we go from continent to continent in our own small world universe. Another strange coincidence that fits exactly into this timetable, location and scene, was another special UFO research project that may, in light of later events, prove to be highly significant. Those familiar with the mysterious phenomenon more recently called synchronicity will understand better what is really going on. In any event, I met Richard Greenwell on another airplane delivery to Lima in 1968. Greenwell was teaching at the university in Lima when my friend with the news clip collection gave me an address and suggested I get in contact with him, that he headed some kind of local organization investigating UFOs. Meeting him proved highly exciting and he had a great deal of information. We got along so well that I later sponsored him so he could come to Tucson to take over the open job of office manager for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, APRO, headquartered here in Tucson, a job which he held for years. This was a perfect arrangement because Richard was bilingual, being fluent in Spanish as well as English. He had even written a thick UFO book in Spanish, one of the classic documents, though it has newer been printed in English. In 1968, Richard was spending a lot of time investigating a UFO photo case that had perhaps the best color photographs of a UFO up to that time in the whole world UFO scene. There were 4 photographs in all, and Richard was trying to establish the facts in this case as best that could be done under the circumstances existing at the time. See Appendix I for a complete report on this investigation as it is pertinent to the story we are about to reveal. Now what is so significant about all this is that those 4 pictures were taken near Yungue, high on the upper shoulders of the massive Mount Huascaran, which lies in a straight line from the Americans' plantation site up the Yavari River, where they were using silver disc-shaped airplanes, and another site north of Pucallpa, also being the entrance to the Uyali Valley and its plantation sites, straight to the nearest waters of the Pacific. And those 4 pictures were taken in the same month of 1967 that the Americans' activity was at its busiest, and the time of the story in the news clip on Palman. A few years later Yungue was completely wiped out in a massive mudslide. Those 4 photographs were of silver disc-shaped flying craft with a dome on top. It was also in this same area, in 1967, that Captain Sanviti was flying a Douglas DC-6 commercial passenger air transport of the Fawcett Airling on a regular run, with a full load of passengers, en route from Chiclayo to Lima, when it was approached from the east, from Mount Huascaran, by a large funnel-shaped flying object that flew all around the transport in flight at close range, in full view of all the passengers, and then flew out to sea. This stupendous demonstration was repeated by a second identical ship that came from the same direction, from the east to the left, as the first funnel-shaped object was disappearing to the west out over the Pacific. Both of these huge machines, bigger than the airliner, came from the same area northeast of Mount Huascaran where we find the Miriam River and the Uyali country plantations operated by the Americans. Is this simply coincidence or is there something more to it? I do not know whether the Indian Akhlatisha was telling his own story or relating somebody else's account. The German food processor did exist and he did have a name although it was not known by the Indians at the time. The plantation operation seemed to be accepted as fact. This would have been a sizable project requiring too much logistical support to go unnoticed, but how were they getting in and out of there? There was no known landing facility up in that country. The Lima newspaper article apparently was making reference to the same operation, but with the characteristic errors of journalistic reporting, the man's name was spelled Palman whereas it was actually Palman. The article called the planet of origin of the visitors Itabira when it was really Itabira. Palman was not returned from the plantation to the Dominican Republic when he left as mentioned in the article, and he did not make his first contact with the extraterrestrials by river from Iquitos.